featured in the personal column of one of the morning papers.
Demobilized officer, finding peace incredibly tedious, would welcome diversion. Legitimate if possible, but crime, if of a comparatively humorous description, no objection. Excitement essential. Would be prepared to consider permanent job if suitably impressed by applicant for his services. Reply at once, box X10.
Clubland Heroes. Iron Truin presents a series of portraits of the creators of the Clubland Heroes. Heroes who are still often portrayed in the cinema and on television. This week he examines the books of Sapper.
With that agony column Creed Occur, Captain Hugh Drummond, DSOMC, bulldog to his friends and mate of His Majesty's loan show, was launched as the arch scourge of the Bolsheviks. The year was 1920, and Drummond's creator, known by his pseudonym Sapper, was in real life a newly retired Lieutenant Colonel from the Royal Engineers. Herman Cyril McNeill had just turned 30 and had judged accurately the mood of the reading public. His creation, Bulldog Drummond, was the all-conquering hero, not averse to taking the law into his own hands. Not until Ian Fleming created James Bond more than 30 years later was there to be so consistently successful a character in English thriller fiction. But already the name Sapper was well known as a writer of war stories written from the trenches, as his friend, Gerard Fairley, relates.
Suddenly, into the office of the Daily Mail, arrived these brilliant short stories about the war. Nobody knew who had written them after a bit. Then they discovered it was this young officer. And Lord Northcliffe said, right, we've got to get him. It was Northcliffe who chose, you see, the name Sapper. By Sapper, for the simple reason that he couldn't think of anything else, and that he couldn't call him Colonel McNeill, because he wasn't allowed to by the military regulations of the time. So he had to call him something, some pseudonym of some sort, and he said, right, we'll call him Sapper, because he is a Sapper. And that's how it all happened.
From the moment that story was published until his death 20 years later, Sapper barely tasted failure. He was born in 1888 in the naval prison at Bodmin in Cornwall, where his father was the governor. Educated at Chelsea College and the Royal Military Academy at Woolwich, he was commissioned into the Royal Engineers in 1907. But storytelling was in his blood, and the first piece he wrote was accepted by a peculiar and long-forgotten periodical, The Winning Post.
The extraordinary, unique character who was the editor of the journal, duly published the contribution, but omitted to send any payment to the young officer. Mac screwed up his courage and went to see the great man in his office. He suggested that he had not intended in this matter to remain an amateur. He was then given the full treatment. Drawers of the editorial desk were exposed and found to be empty. A money box was unlocked and found to contain only a few shillings and a few stamps. And all the while, the charm was turned on to the full. It was almost pleasant to be a victim of the obvious racket. Then the editor made his final announcement. I know a way in which you can get more money for this article of yours than I could ever pay you. There's a big race today up north. Go out and put your shirt on so-and-so, because it's going to win. Mac was impressed at the prospect of getting rich quickly and rushed away from the office to round up a few friends. They pooled all they had, but the money on the horse and the notebook came off. The horse won at a long price. When he told me this story, Mac was probably the highest paid short story writer of the country. And yet, for this, his first literary effort, of only a few words, he received, in this manner, more money per word than he ever received subsequently.
With the outbreak of war in August 1914, Lieutenant McNeill was dispatched to France, and finding time on his hands, he turned again to writing. To explain the mysteries of life in the trenches to a young, unworldly officer, and hence to the uninformed reader back home, he invented a wise old Irish NCO, Sergeant Michael Cassidy.
'Twas in one of the cavalry regiments that a little thing happened which I was seeing. One of the officer gentlemen found a wounded Prussian officer close to our trenches. And in the general clean-up after one of their attacks, 'twas when the cavalry were in the trenches, he gave him a drink out of his water bottle. He took it, and as the cavalry officer turned to go away, the Prussian drew his revolver and shot him dead from behind. 'Twas a big Irishman that saw it done in the officer's troop. And for a second, he stood stock still, not believing his eyes. Then he came to himself, and he bellowed like a bull. He took one leap at the Prussian, and he had his gun in his hand. The Prussian pointed his revolver again, but before his hand was half up, the lad hit it with the butt of his rifle. The revolver went west, and his arm was cracked like glass. The Irishman was making strange noises, and his face was working like a man in a fit. He screamed curses at him, and his language was terrible to hear. And then he raised his gun, and his bayonet was on the end. It was a fierce sight. With a grunt like a pig, he spitted the Prussian's head to the ground, and the steel was 6 inches into the ground on the other side. And when he took his hands away, the rifle stood upright, quivering, with the Prussian pinned like a beetle in a box.
We may have been at war, but in the sapper cannons we played by the rules. In fact, in 1916, he published in the Times a series of articles under another pseudonym entitled The Making of an Officer. The question of honour and of officers caring for the soldiers under their command, above all else, are the main themes of the articles. By 1918, McNeill was a lieutenant colonel, revered by his men, not least, I suspect, because his sense of fair play even extended to solving such a knotty problem as overdue leave.
The leave of four officers, including myself, was long overdue. The problem for Sapper was a difficult one, so he solved it in the following manner. We were at that time in the Ypres sector, near Poperinger. Sapper sent his orderly to the local estaminet to bring back a few bottles of port. He then commanded us to sit round the table, took out a pack of cards, and told us that he would deal each of us a cold poker hand. The game was as follows. The cards were to be turned as he dealt them, and between each of the five rounds there'd be a pause, and we should drink a glass of port to steady our nerves. The maneuver was highly successful, since after five glasses we were all more than relaxed and very happy to congratulate the winner.
So what sort of man was Sapper? Gerard Fairley.
He's a frightfully difficult man to describe. In the first place, he was very loud. He was a loud man. He wore loud ties, and he wore generally loud clothes. His checks were not ordinary sort of little squares. They were huge squares. And generally speaking, he was very loud in everything he did, and his voice. You could hear him on a golf course from miles away. But he was, with it all, the epitome of an Englishman. He was in no sense a person who disliked people ever, at any time, no matter what nationality they were. But in his case, it was a great pity, he thought, that they weren't English, if he liked them.
A Frenchman was advancing towards them down the stately vestibule of the Ritz, waving protesting hands. He addressed himself in a voluble crescendo to Drummond, who rose and bowed deeply. His knowledge of French was microscopic, but such trifles were made to be overcome.
Mais oui, Monsieur mon colonel, he remarked affably when the gendarme paused for lack of breath. Vous comprenez que notre machine avait crashé dans un field, des fields des turnips. Nous avons lost notre direction. Nous sommes hités dans l'estomac. Comme si, comme ça. Vous comprenez, n'est-ce pas, mon colonel?
He turned fiercely on Jerry.
Shut up, you damn fool, and laugh. Mais monsieur, vous n'avez pas de passeport.
The little man, torn between gratification at his rapid promotion
and horror at such an appalling breach of regulations, shot up and down like an agitated semaphore. Vous comprenez, c'est défendu d'arriver en Paris sans des passeports. Parfaitement, mon colonel, continued Hugh, unmoved. Mais vous comprenez que nous avons crèché dans un field des tennis. Des rognons. What the hell are you laughing at, Jerry? Rognons, old boy, sputtered the latter. Rognons are kidneys. What the dickens does that matter? Demanded Hugh. Vous comprenez, mon colonel, n'est-ce pas? Vive la France! En bas les Boches, nous avons crèché.
The gendarme shrugged his shoulders with a hopeless gesture and seemed on the point of bursting into tears. Of course, this large Englishman was mad. Why otherwise should he spit in the kitties? And that is what he continued to state was his form of amusement. Truly an insane race. And yet he'd fought in the brigade next to them near Montauban in July 16, and he'd liked them, those mad Tommies. Moreover, this large, imperturbable man with a charming smile showed a proper appreciation of his merits. An appreciation not shared up to the present, regrettable to state, by his own superiors. Colonel, Butler, Epier, pourquoi non?
That was supper, putting into Bulldog Drummond many of his own prejudices. So what kind of man was it who caught the public imagination in 1920?
Slightly under 6 feet in height, he was broad in proportion. His best friend would not have called him good-looking, but he was the fortunate possessor of that cheerful type of ugliness which inspires immediate confidence in its owner. His nose had never quite recovered from the final 1 year in the public school's heavyweights. His mouth was not small. In fact, to be strictly accurate, only his eyes redeemed his face from being what is known in the vernacular as the frozen limit. Deep-set and steady, with eyelashes that many a woman had envied, they showed the man for what he was, a sportsman and a gentleman. And the combination of the two is an unbeatable production.
Bulldog Drummond was big, he was ugly, he was rich.
The critic, Richard Osborne.
He was idle. That's to say, he hadn't got anything to do, so he could move in all sorts of directions. Had fast cars. Rolls Royces generally, once I think a Bentley, and picked up from Baroness Auxley, I think, he had this troop of obedient and admiring young, rich people, the black gang they became. Algy Longworth, Peter Darrell, and so on, they seemed to have almost nothing to do except to follow Bulldog Drummond round when he blew the whistle. They all got into their fast cars and darted round to Devonshire or wherever it was to fight the good fight. So did Sir Percy Blakeney, the Scarlet Pimpernel, had this handful of totally loyal young men helping him, whom he could rely on absolutely to the death, sometimes to the death.
Two things saved Drummond from what was practically certain death: the heavy coat he was wearing, and the fact that he rolled sideways clear of the steering wheel as soon as the man let go of him with his hand. Had he remained behind the wheel, he must infallibly have gone to the bottom with the car. And at that point, where the river narrowed to come through the piers of the bridge, the water was over 20 feet deep. He had sufficient presence of mind to take a deep breath as the car shot downwards. Then he felt the water close over his head. And if before his struggles to move had been fierce, now that the end seemed at hand, they became desperate. The desire to get clear, to give one kick with his legs and come to the surface, roused him to one superhuman effort. He felt as if the huge heave he gave of his legs against the floorboards must send him flying to the top. Afterwards, he realized that this vast effort had been purely mental. The actual physical result had been practically negligible. But not quite. It had done something, and the coat did the rest. With that one last supreme throw for life, his mind had overcome the effects of the poison to the extent of forcing his legs to give one spasmodic little kick. He floated clear of the car, and slowly, how slowly only his bursting lungs could testify, the big coat brought him to the surface. For a moment or two, he could do nothing save draw in deep gulps of air. Then he realized that the danger was not yet past. For he couldn't shout. He could do nothing save float and drift. and the current had carried him clear of the bridge, out of sight of those on top. And his mind was quite clear enough to realize that the coat which had saved him, once it became sodden, would just as surely drown him.
Richard Osborne mentions Baroness Hawksby. Saffron, in my view, owes much of the storyteller to Kipling, and Gerard Ferry recalls that he was a warm admirer of A.W. Mason. And as we've seen with other Clubland heroes, Buchan's Richard Hannay and Gaunt of Yates' Berry Fadell each had their model. Bulldog Drummond was no exception. I'm sure that many of his characteristics were taken from fellow officers known during the war, but for all practical purposes after the event, it was Gerard Fairley whom Saffer cast his prototype. He actually admitted as much in a radio interview with Fairley for an In Town Tonight programme in 1935. Sadly, no recording survives, but here's a scholarly reconstruction.
I say, Saffer, what did you think of me when you thought of Bulldog?
Aren't you pleased?
Well, it has its drawbacks.
Drawbacks? To be the original of a man at the mere mention of whose name criminals of two continents queue up to pay their income tax?
Yeah, very flattering, I know. But you see, Saffer, you give me such a frightful lot to live up to. Every time anything goes wrong at home, you know, strange noises downstairs in the dead of night, I'm expected to do something. Now, I ask you, is it a friendly action on your part to let me in for that?
Poor old Joe.
But there was a more serious purpose behind the creation of Bulldog Drummond, as Saffer himself acknowledged.
Troubles over demobilization were rife. Men were discontented. The situation was ripe for agitators. Believing firmly that 90% of agitators are concerned with their own pockets and care not one whit for their wretched dupes, I decided to make Carl Peterson an arch-communist. Drummond was concerned as the executive head of a society for the extermination of unpleasing individuals.
People waited for the new Bulldog Drummond book with possibly the same sort of anticipation as one might say one waited for the new Ian Fleming, or our parents or grandparents waited for the new Sherlock Holmes. But they were written with the World War having happened and the Russian Revolution having happened. I once tried to follow this concept through Ian Fleming's work, and it was interesting to me to see how he made Russia the face at the window. I think that when Ian Fleming came to explain James Bond, he used the phrase, and I think Ian Fleming owes a lot to Saffer and would have said so, he was the blunt instrument, as James Bond was the blunt instrument for whatever tales of derring do had to be done.
Really, I think the reason of its immediate and extraordinary success, which was unexpected, I think, by the original publishers, it was what everybody wanted to do. They were bored. The war was over, 4.5 years of it, and they were bored.
Indeed, the original subtitle of the first Bulldog Drummond book read, The Adventures of a Demobilized Officer Who Found Peace Dull. Only recently I came across a copy of Bulldog Drummond with a sticker on the jacket. Read the story, see the play. Gerald Du Maurier in the title role was the hottest ticket in town, but the play's success was tinged with sadness for Saffer. The adaptation was by Du Maurier. For the rest of his life, Saffer yearned to be a successful playwright. His one failing as a writer was dialogue that could not be spoken. He even went as far as to study a playwriting manual, promising his agent a three-act starter by return. But it was not to be. Although Bulldog Drummond appeared again on the stage, and in more than a dozen films, it was often with Gerard Fairley's help.
I don't suppose you saw it, but a kindly woman brought a most delicious touch in the weekly dispatch round to my missus yesterday. It ran thus. Saffer's manuscripts are steeped in the trenches in more ways than one. I hear they frequently arrive in England so wet and muddy as to be almost unreadable. Isn't it my publisher uttering his usual hollow moan about my vile calligraphy?
He always said that if he didn't write one day, he wouldn't write the next. He would write his 2,000 words every morning, half of it from about 9 to about 11, when beer came in, because he loves beer, so did I, and he always had a pin of draft beer at his house, that sort of thing that he can't do nowadays. But after that, he would write again,
said in it for another 2 hours. And then he wouldn't touch anything, and he wouldn't even think of his thoughts or anything. He then insisted that life was made to play golf after that. And he was, of course, the world's most superb high slicer. He used to slice his drives everywhere but on the golf course. And it really was quite attractive to play with him.
Usually after lunch, the Colonel fails to reach the fairway of the first hole. On this occasion, however, the ball flew quite 100 yards down the middle of the course, and the Colonel stepped magnificently off the tee and proceeded to light a cigar. The members drew closer as Uncle James advanced, and even the caddy forbore to hiccup. The moment was tense with emotion. It still lives in my memory, and ever will. "Play back," had said Varden. "Follow through," had ordered Ray. Merciful heavens, they should have seen the result of their teaching. Uncle James achieved the most wonderful wind shot of modern times. He lifted his driver like a professional weightlifter and at about the same velocity. Then, his face grim with determination, he let it down again. To say that he followed through would be to damn with faint praise. The club itself finished 20 yards in front of the Colonel's ball, and Uncle James fell over backwards. "Very good," said the Colonel. "But the object of the game is to get your ball into the hole, not your club."
He wrote on a definite rule, and that was this. He said, writing anything must be controlled by this rule. And the rule was that writing was like a perfect iron shot at golf. It started with the ball being hit, in other words, open with a bang. It went on rising, the ball rising and rising and rising. It meant that you kept the interest increasing, increasing, increasing. Then at the end, right at the end, it dropped as the ball would drop from a perfect iron shot and settle on the green, maybe. Well, exactly the same thing would happen from the point of view of writing a short story, because the interest would have gone had he continued. Even today, that's still marvelous. And every one is a perfect example of that perfect answer.
Sadly, Tapper died before he was 50, but Bulldog Drummond has lived on. That advertisement certainly paid off.
"My dear Box X10, I don't know whether your advertisement was a joke. I suppose it must have been. But I read it this morning, and it's just possible that you mean it. And if you do, you're the man I want. I can offer you excitement and probably crime. I'm up against it, X10. For a girl, I've bitten off rather more than I can chew. I want help, badly. Will you come to the Carlton for tea tomorrow afternoon? I want to have a look at you and see if I think you're genuine. Wear a white flower in your buttonhole."
And then, reader, she married him. In the third of our series, Clubland Heroes,